Loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker. The Netherlands voted yesterday in an election that was a test of how widespread both anti-immigrant and anti-EU sentiment has become. But the far right-wing party failed in its effort to win the election. What will this all mean for the EU and for Europe? U.S. attack drones are headed to South Korea on the heels of a massive simulated invasion of North Korea, the DPRK. Will the Trump administration pursue an even more hostile policy towards North Korea, or will political developments in the South make that impossible? The federal government's power to borrow money to pay its bills expires today. The Federal Reserve Board raises interest rates again. Is a new recession on the way? But first, we turn to the elections in the Netherlands, perhaps the most watched elections in the Netherlands, perhaps in Netherlands history, meaning watched globally because of what it might mean for Europe and global politics. We are joined by Eugene Puryear. He is the host of By Any Means Necessary, a show here on Radio Sputnik, and by Walter Smolarek. He's the producer of this show, Loud and Clear. Welcome back, Eugene Puryear and Walter Smolarek.
Thank you so much for having me.
Good to be here.
Well, these really have been heavily watched elections, Eugene, because their impact, if the far right, semi-fascist or fascist party, I don't know how you would characterize the Party for Freedom, if they had won, it would have a profound impact, even if they couldn't later form a government. In other words, if they just came in first, that would have a profound, certainly symbolic and political impact in Europe. But Eugene, as we're taping this show right now at 10:35 Rotterdam time, the polls have been extended because the voter turnout is so high, highest that it's been in 31 years. It appears that the Party for Freedom, led by Geert Wilders, the anti-Islamic party, the racist party, has not done as well as had been anticipated. Talk about it.
Yeah, I mean, I think that for really the world, a stunning reaction. There's a graphic circulating on Twitter now, aerial view of international journalists running towards international airport, and it's a picture of a bunch of ants because Wilders did not win. So obviously this has been hyped. I think after the Brexit vote, after the win of Donald Trump, many people felt that potentially there was going to be this sort of far-right populist wave, if you will, really far-right anti-Islamically driven, I guess with some populist elements ways, but nevertheless, and I think your characterization of the Freedom Party is fine, something that was not expected. But it's important to recognize as well, in terms of how this result came about, is that the prime minister of the country, Mark Rutte from the Liberal Party, whose party lost some seats, he played very heavily against Erdogan and was able to, in some ways, even though everyone was playing up the bigotry of Wilders, he was able to play a role where he looked like, to some degree, he was the one defending against the, you know, quote-unquote Muslim hordes that Wilders is against. He banned the foreign minister. He banned the family minister, allegedly trying to preventing people from campaigning for the next Turkish referendum, which in and of itself is bad, but nevertheless appearing as if he was the one sort of standing up, standing athwart the border and holding his hand. So he was able to win some other votes. The Christian Democrats, who increased their vote, same thing. And so to some degree, I think that even though Wilders, who had a very positive response to this, he said, we want seats, we're not done yet. I think he knows to some degree that even though in many ways it's a big loss for him, I think in some ways his opponents to the right especially, but even, you know, to the left, I think even the Socialist Party and others were involved in sort of the anti-Erdogan row with you know, some rhetoric that I think is perhaps unfortunate, but nevertheless, you know, that his opponents were able to gain to some degree by posturing a little bit more in his direction. So to some degree, he is still the Pied Piper of a large section of Dutch politics here and the direction that it may go moving forward.
Walter Smolarek, I think that's a good point that Eugene is making. Geert Wilders, a Freedom Party, the fascist or semi-fascist Islamophobic party, the one that's directly in most provocative ways, attacking Muslims, attacking Arabs, attacking people from Turkey. They didn't win. We're just looking at exit polls right now. Again, this is about 10:35, 10:38 time in Netherlands right now, and the polls are not fully closed. So we're looking at exit polls. He didn't win. His party didn't win. But it is as a consequence of the prime minister's party, Mark Rutte's party, having in some ways stolen the thunder of the right, meaning sounding more and more like a directly racist anti-Islamic party. Well, not sounding like, is. And so it doesn't mean that the defeat of this fascist force or semi-fascist force means that a leftist event has happened according to these elections. This, in fact, shows that I think Netherlands is still moving in general to the right.
Yeah, I think that's true. And it reminds me of how Nicolas Sarkozy ran his primary campaign to win the nomination, which was ultimately unsuccessful at doing, but still it was significant that he chose this strategy. You know, when he was running to win the nomination of the Republicans Party in France, which ultimately went to Fillon, he sounded just like Marine Le Pen, who's the head of the National Front Party, which is, you know, basically the French equivalent of Wilders' Party for Freedom. So it's something that's, I think, not unique to the Netherlands. It's something that the so-called like mainstream center-right parties across Europe, certainly you can see this in the Christian Democratic Union, Angela Merkel's party in Germany. They're moving to the right to placate the Alliance for Germany, you know, their version of the Party for Freedom over in Germany. So it's something that we see across Europe, and I think to a certain extent in the United States as well. I mean, it's not a one-for-one comparison, but, you know, the Tea Party is an example of a right-wing, you know, movement, I guess you could say, because it has certainly the element of, like, you know, mobilization. There's a lot of energy behind it. That, you know, when the far right has the initiative, when it has the, you know, control over the direction of politics, the instinct of the establishment is not to combat them. It's actually to compromise with them, to make accommodation to that type of ideology so that they remain in the driver's seat by adopting the views of the semi-fascists.
Eugene, the Labour Party in Netherlands essentially collapsed. This was a huge defeat for the Labour Party, but the Green Party, which has partly a red coloration, not just a green coloration, a connection to the old Communist Party in the Netherlands, they had their best showing ever. Talk about those two phenomena.
Yeah, very interesting. And the Labour Party was in coalition, of course, with the Prime Minister's Liberal Party. I think on first glance, it certainly appears, and it appeared in the polls leading up to it, they would have a historic collapse, that their own voters are punishing them to some degree for their participation in what really has been sort of a center-right, you know, mainstream social democratic. The finance minister is in the Labour Party, and he's one of the main sort of EU officials working on the continent-wide scale on many of these different sort of financial deals, including the Greek bailout. He was one of the people helping take a tough line. Syriza, who I think, you know, the people who really are radical think capitulated completely in the face of the EU and would be correct, called them ideologues. Gives you some sense of where some of the Labour Party leaders really are, how far away they've gotten from social democratic roots even, and how closely they're in sort of a third way Blairite sort of crouching mentality on so many different levels inside of their participation in this government. So ultimately, I think they're punished. The Green Left going up, historic, I think, as in the exit polls, 12 seats. And I think a reflection of that many voters who were looking for a true sort of leftish, social democratic type of politics, something that's more oppositional.
And pro-immigrants.
They flowed towards the Greens. So congratulations to them, I think, for showing that a more positive human-centered politics can succeed even in the course of a lot of the negativity. So I think to some degree, the Labour Party is suffering for its move to the center and away from its historic base. And I think that the Green Left is just well in line with something that's happening all across Europe and the United States as well, to echo Walter's point, which is the sort of resurgence and regroupment of, you know, various shades of left oppositions to the neoliberal regime in the northern sphere. And I'll just say quickly here, too, this also really, I think, changes the equation in France later on in the presidential election.
Well, we're going to talk about that because we have two other big elections coming up, Walter. We have the election in France and the election in Germany. This is, of course, following the change of prime minister in the UK when Cameron left after the defeat of the Brexit vote or his Brexit referendum when it was actually adopted contrary to the desire of the Tories and of the Labour Party. Cameron was out. Theresa May is in. Brexit is happening. Now there's the election in the Netherlands. If Wilders' party, the far, far right, xenophobic, anti-Islamic party had won, that would have strengthened, it would seem, the position of Marie Le Pen, the French party, and also the right-wing opponents of Merkel in Germany. But let's just go again for our audience, which may not really be familiar with Dutch politics. We had the People's Party for Freedom and Democracy. That's the Prime Minister's party. The Labour Party was in alliance with them. So the Labour Party, which is, quote, center-left, was actually with the center-right party as the center-right party moved further and further to the right. Then you had the people, the Freedom Party, Wilders' party, and that party is far, far right. Then you have the Green Party and a few other smaller parties, the Socialist Party, for instance. In general, it seems to me this is still a shift to the right. Now, here's the question. What will this mean in real life in the Netherlands for people who are not European in terms of ethnicity? What will it mean for the Turks? What will it mean for the Muslim populations? Rotterdam is probably almost 50% people who would claim ethnicity other than from the Netherlands. In other words, it was a very multiracial, diverse city. But there is a rising tide of hatred being generated in the Netherlands. It's not going away.
Yeah, I think that's true. I mean, there might be sort of a momentary sigh of relief that Wilders didn't win first place, as, you know, was feared. But certainly the general trend, I agree with you, remains the same. And, you know, the oppression that the non-European peoples in the Netherlands face comes from two angles. I mean, one is from the state itself, which can take the form of anti-working class economic policies that, you know, devastate social programs that working class immigrant communities rely on. It can also be repression from the police. You know, there was a recent demonstration against just the disgusting use of blackface in the Netherlands that was violently repressed by police in Rotterdam.
Including parliamentarians dressing up in blackface.
Yeah, I mean, this is the scale of the extreme racism that's become mainstreamed in the Netherlands. And so, you know, there's the official state repression and oppression that is happening. But then there's also, you know, like the vigilante violence that immigrant communities are facing more and more in the Netherlands and other countries in Europe, where, you know, supporters of the extreme right wing, supporters of Wilders will go out and commit heinous acts of violence against, you know, random immigrants, random, you know, Moroccans have been a particularly targeted group by Wilders himself. He was actually criminally convicted for inciting hatred against Moroccans. He led this just disgusting, outrageous chant, you know, fewer, 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 meaning fewer Moroccans in the Netherlands. So that phenomenon is not going away. And the strengthening of some left-wing forces, you know, there's the Green Left, which made very, very significant gains. The Socialist Party, according to the exit polls, lost the seat, but that's actually a little bit better than the opinion polls had them doing. So it's important to note that, you know, the victory of the or the gains for the Green Left is not because there was like a consolidation of the already existing sort of left of the left vote. It's actually been like a significant expansion of the left in Netherlands politics. So, you know, that's an important trend. And I think that's the only counterweight that can really defeat the rise of the far right.
Eugene Perrier, go ahead.
I think one of the issues, I think Walter is correct here. You know, even the Socialist Party has called for more police. And so I think, you know, the broad theme that I think that you keep coming back to, which is correct, Brian, is I think this is a shift to the right. And I think even some of the leftish parties, and this is a huge problem in the system in the Netherlands and many of these other European countries, the parliamentary parties, the things they agree on, one of them now seems to be more in the mainstream, heavier state police presence and tighter controls for immigrants, which I think is a worrisome trend in that country and several others.
Yeah, that's a good point. I mean, in Germany, it's sort of a similar thing with the left party, right? The leadership of the left party has sort of taken, in some ways, an anti-refugee position. And if you look at the polls, I mean, they're not doing very well. They're going to have not a good election if they keep this up.
Well, we just have about 2 minutes left. Eugene, real quick, we had Erdogan, the Turkish president, trying to pass a referendum in Turkey in April. It may not pass, but the point of the referendum, if it passed with a yes vote, would be to give Erdogan greater presidential power. In other words, to consolidate his seeming sort of personal authoritarian rule. Erdogan was campaigning within the Turkish diaspora in Germany in Netherlands and elsewhere, because it looks like he may fail in this election. So he's telling the Turks who live in Europe, come to the polls and vote for me out of a sort of a nationalist framework. And then you have right-wing parties beating up on Turkey, really for opportunist electoral purposes, to say Turkey, a Muslim country or a predominantly Muslim country, is interfering again on the behalf of these Turks, these Muslims in Europe. And so you have both sides sort of rivaling against each other for their own agenda. And the left is still pretty weak. For the last 25 years, since the dissolution of the Soviet Union and the socialist bloc, the left in Europe hasn't really recovered. And so I'm just wondering, Eugene, as we go forward, I've taken most of your time, but in the last minute, what do we see coming? Can there be a resurgence of the left? And won't it be rooted in both the rejection of the neoliberal policies of the centrist parties, the EU parties, and a defense of immigrants and Muslims and people who are not, quote, European ethnically?
Yes, I think that's very true. I think we can certainly see many of the left-wing parties that have the most energy behind them and are growing the most have exactly those two features. I think we've seen in Portugal that left politics certainly can win when it's done in a more principled way, and certainly can gain and succeed. So, I mean, I think even in Spain, where there's contradictions, it's obvious that there's a powerful growing left movement. So I think for sure there is. I think that you are correct, though, that the key issue is there does seem to be quite a bit of disarray, a lot of different views on the left about what, you know, can be done and what should be done. But at very least, I will say there does seem to be at least some new left-wing energy and new coalitions and things that are emerging, including in Italy, that perhaps could push things forward.
The absence of a coherent left leaves lots of space open for the rise of the right. We've seen this before, of course, in Europe. We've been talking with Walter Smolarek. He is the producer of this show, Loud and Clear, and also with Eugene Puryear. He's the show host of By Any Means Necessary, also on Radio Sputnik. You are listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be back.
Loud and Clear. Loud and Clear.
You are listening to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker. U.S. military attack drones are headed to South Korea on the heels of a massive war exercise simulating the invasion and destruction of North Korea, or the Democratic People's Republic of Korea. Will the Trump administration pursue an even more hostile policy towards North Korea, or will political developments in the South make that impossible? We are joined from Atlanta, Georgia, by Will Griffin. He is part of a U.S.-based task force, Stop THAAD in Korea and U.S. Militarism in Asia and Pacific. You can learn more about them at stopthad.org. Welcome back, Will.
Thanks, Brian. Good to talk with you again.
Thank you for joining. The Guardian reported earlier this week, quote, the U.S. has declared it will permanently station missile-capable drones in South Korea in the latest round of military escalation in northeastern Asia. Those are not my words about escalation. Those are the words of the newspaper, The Guardian. What effect will this decision have on tensions in Korea, tensions in the region?
Well, it's certainly not going to end in any type of diplomatic peace talks or nuclear disarmament talks. This is only going to raise escalations and tensions between North Korea and the U.S., just as it has been for several years now. I mean, it's North Korea actually reacts and responds kind of rationally to how the U.S. is ramping up its military in South Korea and in the Asia and the Pacific, especially in the past several years now. So North Korea is doing what any rational country would do if another military was building up near its borders. And sending these drones, unmanned aerial vehicles, and saying that they will be there permanently is definitely not going to help the situation. One thing that I don't know if that Guardian article mentioned, but I know most Western media outlets have said that the deployment of these drones, the Gray Eagle unmanned aerial vehicles are actually a response to the nuclear missile tests that North Korea has been conducting lately. Well, I just want to throw that out the window, and that is completely not true. These drones would have been deployed with or without North Korea's missile launches. It's part of a plan that the U.S. Army has had, the Master Rotary Wing Aviation Plan, and not to mention that the U.S. foreign policy, the pivot to Asia, or now called the rebalance of Asia, is all part of the U.S. foreign policy that's been planned for several years.
How do you know that? How do we know that?
Well, we know that through history. We know that through especially the Obama administration. And the U.S. has been sending more equipment to South Korea, and it's strongly been demonizing North Korea for several years now. You also have new – it's not just drones that's being deployed. You have missile defense systems like THAAD, and you even have an outside actor, China, trying to mediate this relationship and even warning that, both sides – as they said just a week ago, are like trains that are about to collide with each other, and neither side is giving up. And this is how U.S. foreign policy has been for several decades now, just using military force as a way to interact with the rest of the world.
Yeah, I hear you on that. We're talking with Will Griffin about the announcement that the U.S. forces in Korea are going to have permanently stationed attack drone aircraft. And the reason I was asking you, Will, about how we know about the earlier decision to deploy, in other words, not as a response to North Korean missile tests, but in other words, part of a longstanding plan, is that the fact that the U.S. forces in Korea, that is their official name, more or less, took the unusual step of actually publicly announcing this deployment, unlike the other escalating deployments in recent years, many of which are unannounced. In other words, they were making a point. They're making a political point because of the announcement. And I want to read what the actual official announcement says. Quote, the U.S. Army, after coordination with the Republic of Korea Armed Forces and the U.S. Air Force, has begun the process to permanently station a Gray Eagle unmanned aerial system company in Kunsan Air Base, Republic of Korea. The UAS, that's the unmanned aerial systems, adds significant intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance capability to U.S. forces, Korea, and our ROK, that's Republic of Korea partners. So why the big show of this deployment? I mean, what are they trying to do? We know what's going on, or I want you to help the audience understand what's going on politically inside of South Korea. Is this, in a period of political transition inside of South Korea, a Pentagon effort to make a big statement, hey, we're the big dog here. We're going to make decisions that are going to change the landscape in South Korea no matter what happens with the election that's going to be coming up following the impeachment? Go ahead.
Yeah, the U.S. definitely wants to assert its power and domination in the region of Asia, which, as I mentioned, goes back to the Asia pivot. But also, it's not surprising that they use the word permanent, as in sending these drones to be permanently stationed in South Korea. The past 15, 16 years of this war on terror, we've developed a foreign policy of endless permanent warfare. Right. So it's not surprising that they would use this type of term, saying that they would be permanently stationed there. And not to mention, they're using South Korea's internal political turmoil right now as their advantage to, one, send the missile defense system THAAD and deploy that to South Korea, which originally was planned to be deployed at the end of 2017. But since South Korea's President Park Geun-hye has just been impeached, and before the next president, who most likely will be a more liberal president, Moon Jae-in, they definitely want to set things in motion before the next administration takes its place in South Korea. And the U.S. is definitely just trying to assert its power in any way, shape, and form that it can. And these drones are just another sign of doing that, and also using North Korea as a reason for deploying more military equipment in that region.
A pretext, in other words. President Donald Trump just announced that he's going to increase the military budget by 10%. That would be another $54 billion. Of course, there's much more in the military budget because U.S. wars, say, in Iraq and or in Afghanistan were off the books. Those costed a couple trillion. There's parts of the Department of Energy where a big slice of their budget is the nuclear weapons program. Really, the U.S. military budget is probably close to a trillion when you aggregate all the different pieces of it. Will Griffin, the military budget, according to CIA estimates of DPRK, North Korea, is $4 billion annual dollars, $4 billion. I mean, when you just look at those numbers, you can see the complete ridiculousness of the idea that North Korea poses an existential threat to the United States, while the United States that outspends them by that number and which wiped out North Korea and all structures and killed millions of Koreans during the 1950 to 53 war is actually the victim of DPRK constant menacing. I mean, it's really amazing when you look at the numbers.
I completely agree. I'd also like to mention that the U.S. has constantly threatened North Korea with nuclear warfare and nuclear weapons for decades, since before the Korean War even happened. And the U.S., I would even argue that the U.S. really doesn't even care too much about South Korea and its people. With the missile defense system, THAAD, Obama last year in an interview said that THAAD was to protect the south side of Korea where most of U.S. troops are deployed and stationed. It's not to protect Seoul, where it's a heavily populated, the most heavily populated area of South Korea, and it happens to be near the DMZ. And with this military spending, it's just, you know, we hear the term asymmetrical warfare. North Korea is nowhere near a close military power to the U.S. Yet, you know, the U.S. uses, like you said, North Korea as a pretext, constantly dehumanizes them, and just uses them as a way to sway the American people to keep spending on the military, to increase the military budget, to deploy missile defense systems, to deploy troops, to keep our troops deployed, when really it's only causing more problems. And the U.S. is the most powerful force on the planet that's ever existed, right? There's really no, and to talk about North Korea spending $4 billion, I mean, there's really no military that really has a chance against us outside. The only way I think can actually help solve this problem, at least de-escalate the tensions in the region, is for the American public to understand these situations. And it's kind of like it's going to have to come from within the U.S.-American empire. It's not going to be an outside force that de-escalates this. It's going to have to come within. And I don't think it's the fact that Americans don't care. I think it's just the fact that Americans don't know about these situations. Americans don't know that we have 38,000 plus troops in South Korea, missile defense systems all over Asia, 800 military bases. They don't know that the military industrial complex is $1 trillion a year. But if they do begin to learn these things, then maybe we'll have a chance of de-escalating these tensions.
We're speaking with Will Griffin. Will, it seems to me, and if anyone takes an objective look at history, the history of the Korean Peninsula, you can't help but come to the conclusion that the U.S. is using the issue of security as a pretext for a kind of colonialism, not classic colonialism, but a kind of colonialism nonetheless. And it flows actually directly from classical colonialism. When the Japanese emperor surrendered unconditionally to the United States on August 15th, 1945, after the nuclear destruction of Nagasaki and Hiroshima, part of the conditions imposed by the United States was that the Japanese forces in South Korea, and they had colonized Korea, had colonized it for many, many decades, that they remain in place so that Koreans could not take control of Korea, and that they must remain in place until General MacArthur arrived, which he did September 9th, 1945, and took command of Japanese forces, and thus a new military occupation force ruled over the Korean people. I mean, when you think of that history, you can't come to the conclusion that what the United States was really interested in, as you were pointing out, was what's best for the South Korean people, because nothing could be worse than colonialism or domination by a foreign power.
And let's remind people that after the Korean War, when the split between both Koreas happened and the U.S. backed South Korea, which for decades was a dictatorship. So this whole idea about, you know, spreading freedom and especially democracy, it's just a complete lie. It's a myth. It's never really happened. South Korea was not only colonized in the first half of the 20th century by Japan, but, you know, from 1953 up until maybe the 1980s, South Korea was a complete dictatorship that the U.S. completely backed and supported.
A military dictatorship.
A military dictatorship. Yeah, exactly. I mean, it was harsh back in the day. And the president back then got taken out by his own intelligence agency, which then started a whole democracy movement in South Korea. I mean, not to mention U.S. is some of the strongest allies of the U.S. are Saudi Arabia, a dictatorship monarch, and Israel, an apartheid state. I mean, it shows all over the world and throughout history that the U.S. really doesn't care about supporting freedom and democracy and equality.
The military dictator who ruled South Korea from 1961 till he was assassinated by other soldiers in 1979 was, in fact, the father of the current or just deposed President Park Geun-hye, who has now been impeached. Will Griffin, in our 2 minutes, I mean, we have this long sordid history of right-wing politics, dictatorship, occupation, domination by foreign countries. But as you mentioned, there may be and there will be new elections within 60 days. The Minju Party may win, and they seem to favor a new policy. Will they, do you think, stand up against the United States? Will they, in fact, favor a new relationship with North Korea, a thaw, in fact? What do you think the prospects are here?
Well, I hope Moon Jae-in gets taken in, and there's been a lot of talk about him reversing a lot of the policies that Park Geun-hye put in, which is the conservative administration, and hopefully trying to implement a new type of sunshine policy to open more diplomatic pathways with North Korea. Listen, South Koreans want reunification. North Koreans want reunification. You know, countries like the U.S. need to help those processes and enable those processes to come into fruition instead of harboring them and blocking these pathways by sending military equipment over there and backing conservative presidents like Park Geun-hye, who was, like you said, the daughter of a military dictator from South Korea's history. So, I mean, we just need to shine light on this issue. We need to talk about it more, and we need to support the South Korean people and get U.S. to stop getting in their internal political systems and let them do what they want, give them the freedom to choose who they want to be.
We're out of time. We've been talking with Will Griffin. He's part of the U.S.-based task force Stop THAAD in Korea and U.S. Militarism in Asia and the Pacific. You are listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be back.
Loud and Clear. Loud and Clear.
You are listening to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker. The federal government's power to borrow money to pay its bills expires today as the Trump administration gears up to push through its first budget. In the name of reducing debt, will Trump cut vital social programs tens of millions of people rely on? Will there be a new recession? We are joined from London by Steve Keen. He is a professor of economics at Kingston University and the author of Debunking Economics, The Naked Emperor of the Social Sciences. To learn more about Steve Keen's work and his advocacy, you can go to patreon.com/ProfSteveKeen. That's ProfSteveKeen. Welcome back, Steve Keen.
Good to be here.
Steve, the debt ceiling in the U.S. expires today. For our audience who may not know much about what this means, what is it, and what does it mean for the federal government and for the average person? Could salaries and benefits be affected?
Yeah, well, it's basically an arbitrary number related to the level of GDP, you know, 3 or 4 years ago when the debt ceiling was set, saying we won't go past this level of debt. You know, we're trying to control our debt. We're putting the ceiling. We bump up against the ceiling. We can't borrow any more money. And that's going to control the government to stop it being irresponsible. That's the ideology and the logic that lies behind it. The reality is that because the economy is growing, the government tends to grow as well. It's also part of the reason why the economy does grow. And therefore, so long as the nominal value of American GDP continues rising, at some point you're going to hit that ceiling and have to revise it again. And you therefore go through this regular farce where it occurs and the politicians thump each other from either side of the Congress corridor over who's going to, you know, stop us wasting all this government money and hocking future generations, yada, yada, yada. But it is all really, unfortunately, a sideshow and really a large amount of nonsense.
How bad is it to have a large debt, or is it not bad? Go ahead, talk about that if you would.
Yeah. Well, see, debt matters depending on who you owe it to. Now, if you owe the money to another, to a bank, you're in trouble. As the old story goes, if you owe the bank $100,000, you've got a problem. If you owe the bank $1 million, the bank has a problem. But if the government owes the people money effectively by having sold bonds to them, the government happens to own its own bank, called the Federal Reserve in America. And the Federal Reserve can pay any bills that it faces simply by making an entry in somebody's bank account and recording another entry on its own asset side and creating the money quite simply. And if you look for any Bernanke's speeches and Bernanke's explanations of how the government actually pays for spending and so on, it is simply by accounting operations, which we accept because nobody in America refuses a dollar note or a transfer of money from somebody's bank account to another as payment of bills. So the government actually has a limitless capacity to do that. It comes down to what's the impact of it doing, not whether it can or can't do it. The trouble is the political debate is so childish, frankly, that they talk as if the government can run out of money. And the government can run out of money than you or I could if we actually had an effective counterfeiting machine.
Back in 2004, Ben Bernanke, who was not yet then the chairperson of the Federal Reserve, made a speech to the Board of Governors of the Federal Reserve System, and it was entitled The Great Moderation. And the basic theme of Bernanke's talk was that as a consequence of the Federal Reserve and the government, but especially the Federal Reserve being able to tweak and fine-tune monetary policy, there would not be in the future, or it was less likely in the future, that there would be great depressions or great recessions. That, in other words, there would be still the boom-bust cycle that is a part of the capitalist economic model, but that it would be moderated. Then, of course, 3 years later, the Great Recession happened. Millions of people were sent into foreclosure. 9 million were sent into foreclosure in the United States. About 3 million actually lost their homes. Tens of millions lost employment or full employment. There was no great moderation. In fact, there was a tremendous economic contraction. Do these economists, do the people both in Congress and the Federal Reserve have the ability to know what's coming next?
No, they do have the ability. They could wake up and learn something realistic rather than the nonsense they continue spouting. But the trouble is they do believe an alternate reality, an alternate description of reality, which was doing very well until August 2007. And that's the narrative that Ben Bernanke was on about the Great Moderation. That was the phenomenon. If you look at the unemployment data and the inflation data since 1980, pretty much, you see this trend for inflation to fall over time and unemployment to fall over time. And they interpreted that as being due to their good economic management and thought the ultimate outcome was going to be a very stable economy with low unemployment and low inflation. In fact, that particular phenomenon of falling cycles in inflation and unemployment was an outcome of a model that I did that said if that's happening, it's a prelude to a financial crisis. The reason being what's actually reducing that volatility is an increasing level of private debt. But at some point, when people have taken on so much debt they can no longer service the debt, they stop borrowing and then the economy will tank. Well, that's exactly what happened in 2008. So there's quite a sensible explanation of what happened back in that period that they could avail themselves of, but it involves changing their mindset. And that is probably the hardest thing for humans to do.
Well, in addition to the ideology or the mindset, the consciousness, the perceived understanding of reality, there were, of course, vested interests, particularly the banks and real estate companies. They all had their hand in the pot by extending credit, cheap credit, and then it became increasingly more expensive credit to a greater and greater and greater part of the population, with the promise to the population that even if they couldn't make their debt payments, their mortgage payments, for instance, they could always sell the house and the house would always have a rising price and thus they would recoup. In other words, it was all risk-free. There are vested interests that promote this. That's the engine for it, in addition to bad thinking. What do you think about that?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, if you when you watch any of the movies like Margin Call or Wolf on Wall Street, and you see the predatory behavior that's allowed to happen courtesy of this deregulation of finance, and that people are making money hand over fist at our expense, and they will sell you anything if they can get out the door with the profit on the financial instruments. So, but what actually happened? They could do this because they were covered by people like Greenspan and Bernanke, who believe that all this securitization and selling debt and off balance sheet assets and all the elements of financial speculation, CDOs and so on, they actually seriously believe that was stabilizing the economy. In fact, you can find the current Fed Reserve chairman saying precisely that, that this derivatives would stabilize the economy and reduce risk, to a conference in honor of Hyman Minsky. So it's and of course now she's had to bite her tongue and say how wrong she got that whole thing. But that's, in effect, there's a vested interest who are covered by people who actually believe that this sort of stuff works. And the financial crisis should have been a wake-up call to them, but most of them prefer to remain sleeping.
The Federal Reserve had been expected, or it was anticipated, at least in some quarters, that the Federal Reserve rate, and I want you to help explain what the Federal Reserve rate is to a lay audience, that it would be raised, that it would be increased after having been in basically zero interest rates for almost 8 years. People thought, well, it would happen earlier. But then as it became clear that Donald Trump might win the Republican nomination, then likely to win the Republican nomination, and then he did, in fact, win the presidency of the United States, those rate hikes were put off. But yesterday, again, for the second time in recent months, Janet Yellen is the chairperson of the Federal Reserve, did announce the decision by the Federal Reserve to raise interest rates again, the federal rate. What is that and how impactful is that on the business cycle, the boom-bust cycle, and on the prospects for people getting credit?
Well, it's very impactful, more so than the Federal Reserve realizes, which is why it's dangerous. What that rate is, it's the rate that that the Federal Reserve will charge any bank that wants to borrow reserves from the bank. And that's also, therefore, the rate that the banks will charge each other when they cover each other with reserves. So what actually happens with reserves, if you're shopping at Wells Fargo and I'm shopping, and if you bank at Wells Fargo and I bank at Northern Rock, let's say, dear departed Northern Rock, and you buy something off me, then there's got to be a transfer of reserves from Wells Fargo to Northern Rock. And if Wells Fargo doesn't have the reserves available, then they can borrow it off somebody else and they pay, you know, the Federal Reserve rate. And then that becomes a base rate that is then sort of like the floor that's set for all the rates of interest that we pay when we borrow money off the banks. So it sets a floor for commercial interest rates. And if you raise that rate for the banks, then you are likely to see that passed on, particularly to borrowing rates by private banks, and and not necessarily to deposit rates, but that's what they will end up doing. So it's going to put rates up by of the order of between, say, 0.15 and 0.35 of a percent for the interest rates paid by us for mortgages, credit cards, car loans, and so on.
I'm looking at a blog called Critique of Crisis Theory. It's working, I believe, out of a Marxist framework or one variant of Marxism. The authors write this: since Donald Trump's victory on November 8th, long-term interest rates have risen. This, combined with the decision of the Fed to finally nudge up the Fed funds rate, indicates that the money market has tightened since Trump's election. In the course of the industrial cycle, once the money market starts to tighten, it is only a matter of time before recession arrives. The recession marks the end of one end of the industrial cycle and the beginning of the next. Are we heading towards another recession?
Oh, I think America's locked in a state that I call turning Japanese, because Japan did exactly the same thing. It allowed a private debt bubble to get totally out of control in the 1980s, left it with a private debt level of 2.2 times GDP, and since then it's come down to about 1.7 times GDP, but never risen back up again. So you've never had much credit demand in Japan. And every time there is a period of rising credit-fueled demand and the economy seems to recover, then the government goes and cuts out what it's doing. Either it tries to put rates up or it tries to finish doing its stimulatory spending. And the economy tanks again because people are carrying so much credit. The extra burden caused by a higher interest rate means they start reducing their level of debt, paying debt down rather than taking out new debt and creating credit-based demand. And the economy tanks again. And I can see the Americans repeating exactly the same mistakes as the Japanese have done for the same reason. The people controlling our monetary system do not understand money.
That's a strong position. Yesterday, as I mentioned, the Federal Reserve did raise the federal funds rate, I guess, to the 0.75% to 1% range. This is actually higher than many other advanced countries, Steve Keen, some of which actually are running negative inflation rates. It's still low by historical standards, and this is quite late in the business cycle when rates usually, as you've mentioned, they begin to rise as a consequence, I guess, of government policy. Do they rise regardless of government policy under some circumstances?
To some extent, they do. I mean, when you have if you have a real boom going on, then people who are desperate for money are willing to pay a higher and higher rate for it. So during a boom, you'll get things like my favorite Ponzi speculator in the world is actually a now deceased Australian called Christopher Skase. And he was such an extreme Ponzi that he was always losing money on whatever investments he had, but he would sell them on a rising market. And of course, between one purchase and the sale, he was losing cash, getting less in rental than he's paying out in debt servicing. So he had a desperate desire to get money to pay the installments before they fell due. And he was the firm that provided him with most of his capital. The father and son team behind it would swap whoever saw him each time, put up the rate by 1%, simply seeing if they'd get to a level where he'd say no. He never did. He was finally paying, during the late 1980s, he was paying interest rates of 25 and 27% on borrowed money when the reserve rate was down about 15%. So that pressure can drive up rates during a boom. But generally speaking, the Federal Reserve does have fairly effective control of what we call the short end of interest rates. So the rates where you and I get pay for mortgages and the rates on money market funds and things like that. What they can't control at all so well are long-term interest rates, bonds for 10 and 25 years and stuff like that.
And those are the rates that have been rising, correct, since the election?
Yeah, that's right.
Okay. CNN reported this week, quote, President Donald Trump plans to dismember government $1 at a time. His budget would codify an assault on regulatory regimes over the environment, business, and education, bequeathed by former President Barack Obama, and attempt to halt decades of steadily growing government reach. What do you expect from the Trump budget, and what will its impact be?
Well, it's a very mixed picture because my original expectation was that Trump was going to cause a boom because he was talking about slashing taxes, and he'll certainly proceed with that agenda, but also massive infrastructure spending. If you do the two together, you necessarily end up with a larger budget deficit, which the government can quite easily finance, particularly the American government, because it doesn't face any limitations on international trade because it is the currency for international trade. So you can't run out of American dollars, and America can always import using the American dollars it can produce. So it's basically an unconstrained system. To treat it as constrained is totally wrong. But nonetheless, if he'd done that policy, massive stimulus spending plus tax cuts, there would have been an enormous boost to the government deficit and a strong stimulus to the economy. Now the message is coming across is really it's going to be slashing taxes, yeah, sure, but also slashing government spending. I think he'll still end up in the balance with stimulating the economy because even if he does abolish the environmental protections, abolish science agencies, abolish regulators and so on and so forth, that's really trivial compared to the amount of money that's spent on Social Security, even on health in America, on weapons, obviously, and so on. So I think he's still going to run a budget deficit, still end up giving the economy a stimulus, but he'll be undercutting a lot of people's welfare and health payments. So it's a mess, frankly, and I can only guess which direction it'll go in. So I'm guessing it'll still be a moderate stimulus to the economy, but not as big as he was anticipating. And if at the same time, if the Federal Reserve putting up rates causes people to start deleveraging and paying down debt, then there could be a downturn because of that. Of course, Donald will cop the blame, which will be amusing to see how he handles that.
Right. The blame game will be in full operation for sure. Donald Trump's $1 trillion infrastructure plan may not be an infrastructure plan, and it won't put $1 trillion of fiscal stimulus into the economy, according to some experts. It's basically a scheme for handing over public assets to private corporations that will extract maximum profits via user fees and tolls. What do you think about that prospect?
That's a real problem, because the only way that infrastructure spending actually stimulates the economy is if the government deficit finances it. If instead they set up a whole range of stimuli to try to encourage the private sector to do it, then the private sector may well borrow money into existence to do that, and that'll be a temporary form of stimulus. But it's nowhere near as effective as the government doing deficit spending. And if you get basically a kleptocracy approach coming out of this rather than actual, genuine, worthwhile public services, then it can economically backfire as well as ripping people off on a fairly grand scale. I'm seeing a lot of this over in England, where privatizing the rail system over here means that by having a private rail system rather than a publicly owned one, comparing England, the United Kingdom and London in particular, to Australia, where I used to live, the cost for transport over in England is roughly five times as the cost of transportation in Australia. And I think if Americans start copying this out of what are supposed to be public infrastructure projects, but are actually ways of handing over ownership of public assets to the private sector, then the people will start screaming about it.
Right. We're out of time. A kleptocracy, the rule of the thieves, in a plutocracy, the rule of the rich, a toxic combination. We've been talking to Steve Keen. He is a professor of economics at Kingston University. He's the author of Debunking Economics, The Naked Emperor of the Social Sciences. We will be back tomorrow. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We are out of here.
Loud and Clear.